Hello and good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the Walt Weekly Podcast Friday Live. My name is Walter Latham, your host, and I am joined by Michelle Sweeney McCombs, who is your co-host and moderator. We also, and she will be taking the lead in our interview today, we also have our panel of thought leaders, along with our esteemed guests, who will be introduced to you by Michelle Sweeney McCombs. It's a big day for Michelle. She got all these tasks, Michelle. I'm telling you.
I'm just loading you up. I'm gonna need a raise, dude.
Yeah, you got it. You earned it.
Yeah.
But before we proceed, let me just wish our friend, a great friend of our show, Oscar Sanders. Today is his birthday.
Awesome.
And he is a true friend to the TWW family. So I wish him a great day today. And I am going to put a little... I was going to put some applause in here, but my screen is stuck, so we're just going to move on. But anyway, we can do it manually.
Yes. Happy birthday. Yeah.
Happy birthday,
Oscar.
Yeah, and also,
Oscar.
Congratulations to Ernest again.
Oh, yeah.
Married of bliss. Yes, Ernest.
Well, you've been married a long time there, Ernest.
Yeah, two weeks and a day.
Two weeks and a day. Oh, that's really sweet.
You can speak on that, man. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
Tell me right about already, huh, Ernest?
Yeah, I'm telling you, man. Oh.
That's funny.
Anyway, moving right along here. All right, today's show... I got a question. Have you ever heard of these high-profile athletes removing themselves from the spotlight due to mental issues? I mean, is this something new? Because I've been wondering. I mean, I've heard, some blowback, like they must be weak. And these people have reached the pinnacle of their careers. Yet they are asking for time away from the activities that they love and excel at. So I would like to know why. But I would like to know why. I mean, you get to the top of the mountain there, something that you worked for all your life, and you have to step away. So our guest today, who Michelle will introduce, has firsthand knowledge of being in this position. Okay, so with that said, I'm going to turn it over to Michelle. Michelle?
And share this podcast by clicking the share button below. Today's Friday Live is brought to you by Michelle Sweeney Hair and Skincare, and our intro and outro music is provided by Uncle Nephew. Before introducing our special guest, let me introduce the Walt Weekly panel members. I will put everyone's information in the chat room as well. First up, of course, is our engineer, Gregory Coleman out of North Carolina, owner of Illumination Media and Technology. We have also Ernest J. Robinson out of Washington, D.C., retired sergeant veteran, newly reenlisted U.S. Marine Corps. He's senior consultant at B. Ernest Leadership and Professional Consultant. Christopher Sweeney out of New Jersey, retired sanitation worker and CEO of Johnny Roof's Smokehouse. We have poet and author Judy Andrews out of Brooklyn, New York. Walter, please give them a hand if you have any props. That would be nice. If not, we'll move on. Awesome. Awesome. So tonight I'm honored to have a retired WNBA player, a graduate of Stanford College. She was drafted in 1996. Round 2, number 11 overall. Her career expanded from 1996 to 2002. She averaged 10.2 points, 6.2 rebounds, and 1.3 assists per game in her 157-game career with the San Jose Lazers, Seattle Reign, Detroit Shock, and Minnesota Lynx. She began playing during the 1996 season and last took the court during the 2002 campaign. She is currently a certified performance mindset coach. Let's welcome Ms. Val Whiting Raymond. Welcome, Coach Val.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
For the introduction.
Welcome. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. We're going to freestyle tonight. We're not hitting hard questions, but just briefly tell us about yourself, even though I gave some. I know there's some stuff in there you can fill in for us, especially with your career in the WNBA.
Mm-hmm. So I played college ball at Stanford University, and when I was there, we were part of two national championships, four Pac-10, it was Pac-10 at that time, Pac-10 championships, and I left as the Pac-10 all-time leading scorer and rebounder. Women's basketball wasn't in the United States when I graduated from college, so I had to go overseas, and I played in Italy, Israel, and Brazil. And then in 96, piggybacking off of the success of the 1996 women's national team at the Atlanta Olympics, the American Basketball League started. We end up having 9 out of the 12 Olympians, players like Dawn Staley, Teresa Edwards, Katie Smith, Hall of Famers today. And that league started in 96 and went through 1998. And meanwhile, the WNBA was there at the same time in 1997. So we were competing, the ABA and the WNBA were going at the same time. Right. The league folded halfway through the third season. And then I went to the WNBA and I played for the Detroit Shock and Minnesota Lynx. So in the 1999 season, I was on and off the injured reserve because of depression, and ended up taking off the next season for mental health, the whole 2000 season. And back then, people really didn't talk about it. And I didn't tell anyone about it. I just said that I left for personal reasons. So when I look at the athletes today actually coming out about their struggles, I wish I could have been as brave, but I also know that it was a sign of the times.
Right. So how can you tell us, how did you deal with it when you took the break?
I didn't deal with it well, because when you're an athlete, your sport brings you joy. And when I was playing basketball, it would bring me joy, but also bring me sadness. I was way too hard on myself. If I'd make a mistake in a game, I'd hold on to it. I overanalyzed everything. My expectations of myself were just way too high. So you couldn't be harder on me than I was already on myself. And all of that eventually wore down. And I do have a family history of mental illness as well. So I believe the fact that I didn't have the tools to deal with those things mindset-wise, it led to me spiraling out of control.
Wow. So what steps did you take to get the help that you needed once you were spiraling out of control? When did you decide that, hey, I need help?
First, I had to decide I needed to take a step back, and that was hard. Financially as well, because, you know, that was the only way I was making money during the summertime. Right. And to be honest, I didn't really get the full amount of help I needed until 10 years ago when I had 3 psych hospitalizations. So when I was going through it, I thought I had recovered and had come back, came back to play in 2001 and still was feeling sad, but not feeling totally depressed. It was just a low grade level of depression. And then I realized 10 years later that I was playing with undiagnosed bipolar depression. So I wasn't even diagnosed correctly. So like I said, I finally started taking serious about my health and my mental health in 2011.
Okay. Walter, you want to come in a little bit for that? Because I know you have a question.
Yeah, let the panel come in.
Okay.
I got a couple, but it's further down the line.
Okay. So we're going to start with Greg, and we're going to focus on the mental health issues. If anyone has a question for that, we'll go down the line. So, Greg, we'll start with Greg, Chris, Ernest, and then Judy.
Val, I know it's definitely a privilege having you on the show. We thank you for coming and speaking, about a topic that I think, is getting a lot of attention recently, but how much progress do you think has been made, or do you think there's been progress made in dealing with athletes and mental health issues?
I think there's progress because people feel that they can speak out about it, but I don't think it's progress because the average person, if I think about internet trolls and the comments that I was reading, that people were talking about Naomi, things they were saying about her, or Simone Biles, I feel we just have a ways to go because people view athletes as superhuman and we live this charmed life, and what do we have to be depressed about? Or what, you know, they're making millions of dollars. They're living better than, you know, 99% of the people. So why should they be depressed? And I feel like there's a lot of lack of empathy, which I noticed. And maybe I would have been that way myself if I didn't go through what I went through. Mm-hmm. So I think we've progressed to people who are talking about it, but people still are looking at having mental health issues as a sign of weakness.
Yeah, that was one of the questions that I had. I'm sorry to jump in, but I thought I would jump too far ahead. But that was a segue into a question that I had. But I heard that athletes coming forward are just weak. And I heard that numerous times, and I heard it associated with athletes of color, especially female athletes of color. Do you see that in the landscape?
I'm laughing because people, now this conversation, I've never seen this conversation had, but a lot of, when you're a black athlete, the expectations on you are just different. Your coach, and my coach is a great coach at Stanford, but she had different expectations of the black athletes than the white athletes. There was an athlete on our team that there were certain things she didn't have to do that we had to do. We had to be tougher. We had to be bigger. We had to be faster. We had to be stronger. And I just felt she was allowed to show weakness when we weren't. So, I mean, that's a whole nother story. And I don't know if it even ties into this. The whole concept of the strong black woman, and we're so used to being strong that people expect us to always be strong. And then when we're not feeling strong, then we're totally we're criticized. Now, I don't know. I don't have a comparison of how a white female athlete has come out about her mental health. I don't have a comparison. Maybe you guys can think of something. But from my observation, it seems that the two black women that have come out, people have gone hard at them.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and it seems like they're trying to use them as a stereotype, you know, to fit into some type of mold. And so, see, these are black people, when they get to the top, they're weak. You know, they don't want to go that extra step. You know, you don't see, well, I haven't seen a lot of, maybe it's me, maybe it's, I haven't seen a lot of white women come out and say, okay, I'm depressed. But it's not just a women's issue. I mean, we're talking general here, you know, men and women. Like Robin Williams, he just committed, he was depressed, he just killed himself. Nobody even knew that he was going to do that. They knew he was depressed, but they didn't take it seriously. So, yeah, I agree with you. But, you know, even how trolls are.
Yes, and I am a social media influencer on TikTok. And my channel is dedicated to female athletes. And I talked about my struggles with depression as an athlete when I was playing. And the teenage boys came down on me, called me weak, and I'm making excuses. So it's starting young with the view. So if they're feeling this way now, how are we going to change the cycle if we had kids still saying the same things that adults are saying today?
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to interject there, but that was one of my leading questions. I didn't want to jump ahead. But we'll go back to the order, Michelle. Sorry about that. Thank you.
No, you're fine. You're fine. Thank you for that. Chris, we'll go to Christopher next.
Hey, good afternoon. I got a two-part question. How much of what you're going through with your experiencing with depression is attributed to sports through you being an athlete and how much is it of it is from your childhood upbringing? Because for me, many of us in the African-American community are dealing with depression and mental illness, and really it's very hard for people to come out in that community and have a real discussion about it. So how did your family help you, if they did, through this process?
My family, they were really clueless about it. No one spoke about it, and only mention was my grandmother had a nervous breakdown. I still don't know what that means. That was the only mention of mental illness in our family. So when I was feeling suicidal, because that's why you go into the psych hospital, I didn't even tell my parents. I couldn't tell my parents. I just didn't feel comfortable telling them that they would understand. And stack that on the fact that I'm a Christian, and the guilt, I was having so much guilt because I was feeling this way, but I still believed in Jesus. And then I didn't have anyone on the Christian side I didn't have a pastor to talk to about this, because everything is, and I believe in prayer, but everything is prayed away instead of being always practical. Maybe I have a biochemistry issue in my brain that I need to take medication to stabilize it. So it was really complicated when I was trying to talk about what I was going through, because it was, you definitely feel alone. And I was feeling embarrassed because everybody knew who I was. And I'm this athlete, and I'm supposed to be big and strong and not showing weakness. So I was dealing with that as well. And if any interesting part is, when I went in for my first psych hospitalization, people recognized me. Aren't you Val Whiting, the WNBA player? So I couldn't even heal and be anonymous, and that, so it was just it was just a whole bunch of stuff going on.
As a parent who has a child that is dealing with mental illness, and I have other close family members to me going through the same thing, it's kind of difficult, right? Because I'm trying to relate to my child and trying to understand, which I don't, you know, I don't pretend to fully understand. And you try to be patient and you try to have the conversation. And when you're on the other side of it, right, and you're trying to reach out, and you kind of, it's tough, because when that person is in that space of hopelessness, it feels like they're pushing you away or not accepting your help, or you feel like you can't help them, or you feel, you feel helpless, or you failed them. It's so many emotions going through. That's why I asked how the family was, because it's not something that you just go through alone, you know, even though it's your issue, right? But it's a family issue, and the whole family goes through it. And it's very difficult, you know, as a parent to watch your child suffer and you can't do anything. So it almost makes you feel like you just lost every bit of control over the situation, which you probably never had control over it. It's so hard to be in that space, because when you go to the doctor is limited on what they can tell you, because they got to keep certain things patient confidentiality, but you want to be in, on that process, and it's really, really tough. So I salute you for coming forward and sharing your story. And I hope, you continue to be successful in your fight against this. And thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you sharing as well.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Judy. You're next.
Okay. I thought that Ernest was next. Thank you so much, Val, for being so transparent and honest about your experience. I have a question regarding your childhood and how that played a part in developing these feelings of depression. Did it come from the media when you became more famous? Or was this something that was brewing from your childhood that developed as you got more famous? That's part of the question. And the other question is, what advice would you give to a parent who has a child who's an athlete who, you know, may feel inadequate? I understand that you had an issue with self-esteem growing up. And I was wondering, did that play a part in the way you were developed in professionally?
I think it did play a part because the majority of my, not majority, but elementary school and middle school, I was bullied heavily. And so I had a horrible sense of self-worth, and that carried into basketball because I started looking at basketball as who I was. If basketball was going well, then I was awesome. If it wasn't going well, then I was a terrible person. And I think that when basketball wasn't making me feel that great, that played into how I was feeling mentally, with regards to my mental health. I also, like I said, I believe I have a family history of mental illness. I'm not undiagnosed, so it's also genetic. But I do believe that my childhood played a part in it. And I had a great childhood with regards to my parents. My parents are still married 55 years. We're not a perfect household, but very, very supportive. But I think outside of home, I struggled with different things. And as a parent, I have a 20-year-old son and a 16-year-old son, and they're both athletes. And what I try to do to support them is I try to give them the tools with regards to their mindset. When they make a mistake, letting it go, not being so hard on themselves, not trying to be perfect. That was my thing. I wanted to be perfect, and just supported them that way. So when they're feeling a certain way about their sport, and or something's going on in the game, they can bounce back and they can look at it not as the end of the world. I had a lot of all or nothing, black or white thinking that plagued me as well. So, and I'm not saying every athlete who goes through depression or has a mental health crisis, it stems back from the fact that they had didn't have the mindset tools to deal with the pressure and competition. But for me, I felt that that's what led to it. I just didn't know how to cope correctly, and then it just went in the wrong direction.
Right. I also read that you dealt with feeling, you know, the sense of being a role model and being able to explain to the people you tried to, you know, help along the way, the young people that you mentor, that you don't have to be perfect, and that maybe striving for perfection creates a sense of extended pressure in the sport and in the world of entertainment and being a celebrity.
It does. That's a great point. And especially with the whole social media stuff right now, it's just out of control. Like, kids have their sense of value based on how many likes and views they're getting. And, you know, they're putting filters on photos so they can look a certain way. So the pressure is at an all-time high. I mean, not only just for young people, but young people who play sports and then young people who end up being household names.
Wow, correct. Thank you so much. Right. It is really difficult. That's correct. You know. Thank you for sharing this.
Appreciate that.
Because it's not something that's talked about in, you know, the African-American community.
Oh, no, you're right. Right. About that.
It's definitely not spoken of many households. It's just something you don't speak about in the black family. So it's good that you're you know, not keeping that same pattern with your sons, speaking on it. So I'm going to bring in next, because I'm not sure if Ernest is here. Diva with Depression, Donna Hairston, is on the line. She is an expert dealing with depression herself. She's also part of the suicidal hotline, and I would like for her to bring in her opinion and also speak on the today's the actual anniversary of it, isn't it, Donna?
Yes.
Suicidal Day.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes. Okay. We can hear you.
It is. It's World Suicide Prevention Day today, and September is World Suicide Prevention Month. That was a tongue twister.
Yes.
But I wanted to say, Ms. Val, forgive me because I did not see your last name. I want to say that I applaud you because I have followed the WNBA for years, and I was very vocal. My brother's on the line, so he'll tell you that I was very vocal about how the women in the WNBA were treated, and I was always so disgusted. And that'll cause depression itself, you know. But I think that one of the things that I want to touch on that you were speaking on is trying to be perfect. And I think that as far as Black women are concerned, we have to kill the myth of the superwoman. We believe that, you know, it's a common misconception that Black women can handle everything that's thrown at them and, you know, and brush it off and keep on going. And in turn, we end up sweeping our problems under the rug. And so that can lead to breakdowns and depression and, you know, physical health issues, just trying to live up to that picture perfect image. And so I think that when people like yourself speak out, you let people know that it's okay to not be okay, that, you know, you can live with mental illness and still function and go on to do wonderful things. It's not a death sentence, so to speak. So I think that that's a great thing. Because, you know, look at where you are in the world. You're a celebrity and you're saying, I live with this, but I'm still standing. And, you know, like Judy said, you want other younger people to know and other women to know that it's possible to do it. It's a struggle, you know, because there are varying degrees of mental illness. And some days it's hard to get out of bed, but you know, we can still do it and we can still function and go on.
Thank you for that. Donna, can you give the hotline and the information that you can provide, or you can just type it in the chat room if you like.
Read it out loud because I'll lose you if I try to type. So there are different organizations. I personally volunteer with NAMI, which is the National Alliance for Mental Illness. And so I work their helpline in Charlotte. But the National NAMI helpline is 800-950-6264. And if you need immediate counseling from someone from NAMI, you can text capital NAMI to 741-741. Which is also the crisis assistance text line. If you text the crisis assistance text line, you would text them HOME, home, and you do that in capitals, and it's texting to 741-741, and they're 24-hour service, and they are, the great thing about them is that they will text because they know that people like myself with mental illness don't like to talk on the phone. And so they will text back and forth until they're satisfied that you're safe and offer you resources.
Amazing.
The National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 800-273-8255. And that's another 24-hour helpline if you call it and you don't feel safe. And my last thing is this. And, you know, I talk to Chris about this all the time, about our kids, because, you know, we are in a similar situation. Both of my kids suffer with a mental illness also. We have to just continue to be open, be honest. If you feel, you know, when you don't feel well, You know if you have a cold, you know physically if you don't feel well, but you also know if you're not mentally feeling well. And so if you feel that way, never ever be ashamed to seek out a therapist or seek out a psychiatrist or even join a support group. NAMI has free support groups. You can join on and talk to people that are living with the same illness that you're living with. There's no shame in it. And the more you speak out, the better you'll feel. And you know that you are not alone in the fight. There are people, millions of people around the world that are living with
it. Right.
So please reach out to someone if you are not feeling well.
Thank you for that. All of this information will be, this show will be rebroadcast on Sunday, but we will have all of this, these details in the show notes as well for anyone for the future. So I'm going to bring in Gene Anthony Edwards. He's male district leader out of the Bronx, New York. You're up next, Gene, if you'd like to address a question to Ms. Val.
Yes, yes. Thank you, panel, and to our host, Walter, and to our special guest. You know, I really, really appreciate you being on this show. It really means a lot. You know, we're tackling a different issue, and that's what this show is about, doing something differently every week. I apologize for being tardy. I'm normally on time, but as Michelle said, I'm the district leader. We're doing a bunch of back-to-school events here in the South Bronx, and that's what I was doing all day today, so I apologize for that. But it was all for a good cause. Val, I'd like to applaud you because when I was a young man in the military, I was stationed in the Pentagon, and this is in 1995, and my wife and I settled down. We had a home. We wanted to have a child, and that was the inception of the WNBA was at the beginning of June of 1995, and my daughter was born on June 28th of that year, so it was good to take her to WNBA games to see the Washington Mystics, who had drafted the great Shamika Holdsclaw. And, you know, to get my daughter a jersey and for her to realize that, you know, she could one day grow up to become a professional basketball player. So, you know, I like to thank all the women that were at the vanguard of the WNBA. I really salute you for that. Here's the problem that my daughter faced as she got older playing basketball. She played basketball at a... Oh my gosh, she's 26 now. Bishop McNamara in Oxon Hill, and it's in Prince George's County, Maryland. It's one of the more premier Catholic schools, and they have a great sporting program. And she was the starting starting power forward, and she also played softball. And when she was going to Morgan State, I told her to try out for the basketball team there. And she said, "I don't want to, Dad." I said, "Why not?" She said, "I kind of got turned off after my senior year." I said, "Why?" She said, "Because you told me about the birds and the bees, but you didn't tell me about the birds and the birds." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Dad, I was getting so sexually harassed in the locker room. I was scared to take a shower until everybody left. Sometimes I had to punch girls in the face because they were too aggressive." And I think that really stopped her from having a collegiate career in college basketball. So to that, to the mental health professional and to you, Val, how do you feel about sexual harassment in the locker room and in sports for women?
Well, I'm sorry your daughter had to go through that. I've heard stories before around that. I personally have never experienced that, but I don't know if anyone else has heard anything about that. That's totally just inappropriate. That would turn anybody off, and I'm so sorry that she had to go through that. And yes, with women's basketball, it is a large percentage of us are lesbians or bisexual, but I have not ever experienced that at the professional level or any level. Excuse me.
Wow! Thank you for that. Thank you for that. So I'm going to go on to Ernest. You there, brother?
Oh, yeah. Ms. Whiting, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so very much for being here. As I was listening, to everyone's talk conversation. I think in the beginning you had asked about an example of a white athlete who experienced mental health, and the first person that came to my mind was Elena Deladon. Interestingly enough, it was around the same time, not same time, but same portion of her life in high school to college that Jean's daughter experienced trying to go from high school to college, where she was burnt out from playing basketball. And she chose to go, she was supposed to go to UConn, and then she chose to go to University of Delaware, played volleyball. Then she got back into it, but her parents had burnt her out mentally from even wanting to play. And I just wanted to throw that in there. But I think sometimes that when we look at athletes and mental health as the topic of this particular show, I think sometimes we need to focus mostly on just the mental health and not necessarily whether or not if they're an athlete. Myself, Gene, Greg, we're all military veterans. And there's 22 veterans who, you know, commit suicide, you know, each day. And there's a lot of focus that's on that. But I think if we just focus on how do we, you know, address just the mental health and not necessarily, you know, focus on whether or not they have an athletic mindset or a military mindset, because a lot of people tend to break down. And some of it may be hereditary, as you alluded to. Some of it may be further compromised by their by the status of being a celebrity or being in, you know, whatever situation. So are you currently working on any particular legislation or any particular activities that kind of address the crux of mental health across the board, despite anyone's designation as far as being an athlete or otherwise?
Currently, I am not. I have a program that's for female athletes that works on mindset, but not, we don't get into the deep of things with regards to, it's not therapy or, and I'm not a licensed professional, but that's been my focus, athletes, female athletes, and their mindset. So I'm not working on any legislature right now. And with regards to Elena Deladon, I know her family. Where I'm from, Delaware. Elena and I went to the same high school, meaning I'm older than she is. And when she took that break from basketball, she was working out at my gym. I remember that night, that week was a crazy week, that she went up to UConn, then came back and ended up going to UD, but didn't even play basketball at UD, played volleyball at UD for a couple of years and then turned to basketball. And it's interesting, I didn't even think of that as mental health. I always just thought, oh, she was burnt out. So it's funny how even my perspective was off about what she was going through as an athlete with all the pressure. So Elena, if you guys don't know her, she's in the WNBA now. She's 2-time MVP. She plays for the Washington Mystics. But in high school, she was, they called her the female LeBron James. So she had all this hype around her in high school. She even was in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most consecutive free throws in a row. She was the number one recruit in the country. She was going to UConn and then got to UConn and just missed home and then left in the middle of the night and came back. And it was like a big deal. And everyone thought her career was over. And if you don't go to UConn, then, you know, you're not going to make it. And right now she went to UD, which is a University of Delaware, which is a mid-major school, and now she's one of the best players in the world and was just named one of the top 25 players in 25 years for the WNBA. So I always like her story because it just shows how you don't have to take that path everyone else thinks you're going to take, and what God has for you, he has for you. So I'm glad you brought Elena up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I try to make sure, you know, I'm just objective about like everyone that, you know, that goes through. I mean, again, Kevin Love obviously has gone through it. Mm-hmm. You know, male or female athletes have gone through. I think that some of the conversations that are going around, I think a lot of people take advantage of mental health as an out of underperforming. And it's on, sometimes it is, you know, we, it's a very touchy subject, right? But when you're not giving it your all, you know, or you're just having a bad day, sometimes you're just having a bad performance, and it's, can you say, is it mental health or is it not? Right. But I think some people are using it as a scapegoat to, because of their underperformance. And I've seen it, people have abused it, even in the military, even some veterans, like they'll say that they have a traumatic stress or whatever, and they really don't. Or they exaggerate what it is that they're actually going through. What do you think about that, or say about, you know, for those who are, you know, inappropriately, you know, either self-diagnosing or trying to use something as a scapegoat, that is really a very touchy subject that needs to be taken seriously.
Do you have any examples of athletes who have done that? I'm just curious because I can't think of any offhand.
Well, again, it'd be one of those things that you would have to, you know, you would have to kind of, you know, look at to say when I, you know, did this person really have, was this person diagnosed? And again, it comes one of those things where it becomes a judgment call. So you have not seen that where you think that someone is using it where they're just underperforming and insane as mental health, or do you, or is it one of those things we just want to believe?
I don't, me personally, I wouldn't want to pretend to have, you know, the five disorders attached to my name, you know, to put that excuse out there as underperforming. So still a stigma involved with having mental health issues that I can't imagine that someone would want to do that. Right. That's just my opinion. When I got diagnosed with a whole bunch of stuff, I didn't even want to even think about it. I thought I was so flawed, and I didn't want to even put that out there. So I can't imagine that someone would go through that just to say, well, I didn't score my 10 points last night. I'm depressed. It takes a lot to come out and say that stuff because it's a stigma that's associated with it.
Yeah.
So I don't think people would do that lightly.
Definitely. I think, Donna.
No, go ahead, Michelle. Donna.
I just wanted to address a couple of points that Ernest brought up. Up until I started this platform a couple of years ago, I always associated PTSD with the military because that's what society believes. But PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder. And that means that it's any trauma that you experience in your life. And so I'm in therapy for PTSD because of different traumatic events that happened in my life. So we have to, and I'm not taking away anything from veterans because I think that, you know, as far as mental health is concerned, veterans are treated like crap anyway. I think we all are because of the stigma. You know, you go into the military and you're considered, you know, strong and, you know, ruha, and you're not allowed to be soft. You're not allowed to have emotions. And I think that that's part of the problem also. But PTSD is for everybody, you know, who experiences a traumatic event. And secondly, I'm with Ms. Whiting. Nobody, I would not wish this on anybody, even my worst enemy. Well, one worst enemy, but everybody else, I would not wish it on because it is hell to live like this. Yeah. And excuse me, my voice cracks up when I talk about it, but it's hell to live like this. You know, like Ms. Whiting said, she's got four or five attached to her name. I've got four or five, you know, just mental illnesses attached to my name, not even talking about the physical illnesses. So, you know, yeah, there are some people that may say I'm depressed today, or, you know, I didn't do whatever because I was depressed today. You know, those people may not understand what the real definition of depression is. You know, those people may not understand that this is, in a lot of cases, a genetic disease. And, you know, we're battling this tooth and nail every single day. And, you know, it's not just athletes that are not performing, or, you know, celebrities that are not performing because of you know, their depression. It's everybody. You know, when I can't complete a podcast, or, you know, I ask my brother, I'm crying every week if I can't complete my podcast because I feel like a loser because my mental health is tanking and I don't have the energy. I don't have the brain space. So no one, right. You know, you have to really be out there to want to experience something like this, you know, as an adult, as a child. It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. And I think that we forget that we are on 24/7, you know, with social media, you know, just our phones, you know, so the bullying rates have gone up, the depressing news cycles have, you know, just hit the pandemic, everything. We are 24/7, we're being bombarded with sadness, you know, and right. So if you're already living with a mental illness, that just takes it another step. And if you've never experienced, I get calls every day with people that have never experienced a mental illness, but in the past year and a half, they have, you know, because of everything that's going on. So we have to stop being so rude and judgmental about people in their fight, because just because you don't understand it doesn't mean that it's not going on. You know, like I'll use Kanye West as an example. I'm not a fan of his, and I do think that he's mentally ill. And I do think that sometimes he may use that to his marketing advantage, but I don't take away from his mental illness. And that's where we have to draw the line. You know, we have to be open to accepting that if someone is feeling something, they're feeling it. And it's not anybody else's place to say that they're not justified, because we're teaching our children that they can't be open. They can't be emotional. Our little boys are growing up to be, you know, hardened and soulless, because we teach them that they're not allowed to be vulnerable Black men. They're not allowed to be soft Black men. They're not allowed to be talk and love. We can't continue to do that. We have to be open to everything. Christian, you know, the religious community.
Yes, Walter, you want to add anything in there?
Hey, yeah. Hold on, Michelle.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to speak to what Ernest was talking about with athletes,
mm-hmm.
and mental. I think that applies more to football, because quarterbacks, once they take too much of a licking during the game, they start taking off and running and making bad passes, and that's called hearing footsteps. That means that they've been hit and taken to the ground so much that they begin to think that the defenders are actually closer than what they are, and then that causes them to perform badly because they're hearing footsteps. And as far as mental health, I went to a therapist last year for 10 months, and it was the best thing that ever happened, because I suffered from something called an adjustment behavior, or a behavioral adjustment. And basically, what it was is that I was allowing my thoughts to become my reality. So, you know, I would act out on what I thought, as opposed to what it really was. And sometimes I was, hello? Oh, because everything got quiet. And, you know, sometimes I would, like, create my own reality in advance of an event or a situation, rather than just staying calm and letting things play out. And it caused me to have some outbursts and going off on people unnecessarily. I became a very unpopular guy because people didn't want to be around me, because I was, you know, people didn't know whether, because like one minute I'm cool and the next minute I'm going to be on your ass. And that became, you know, I became the type of guy that nobody wanted to be around. And I went to therapy for 10 months. And now I'm like the nicest guy I know. Don't you all love me? I'm a nice guy. Therapy works. So I always encourage brothers. I encourage brothers to go to, I encourage brothers to go to treatment, because Black women do it. Sisters talk to each other and then they go, even if they go together. But brothers have this stigma that if right, you have to go right. see a mental health professional, somehow you're weak. No, not admitting that you have a problem and being afraid to go makes you the punk. That's what I tell them. Being afraid to go makes you the punk, not going. And with that, I'll digress.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, team. Thank you. I do want to make a point, and I think it's still out there in some circles, and even in professional circles, medical, that psychology is not an exact science. It's, they don't consider it a science. All right. So what I'm thinking is that, you know, if you have professionals, especially in the medical doctor, you know, the physical, and they think that psychology where you go to get help is just, you know, voodoo and magic and this and that, it's nothing concrete. How do you feel about that, Val? And then also, second question, what are some of the symptoms? And I'm addressing this to Val and to deal with depression. Is what are some of the symptoms of mental illness that you felt before you said, okay, I better go get some help?
So your first question is with regards to psychiatry not
being right. I mean, you science. Have people, right. Is it a science? You know, you got people that don't, even professional medical people don't believe that psychology and psychiatry is a science.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was a lot of experimentation with what, with regards to medication, what works, what doesn't work. There was like no test that they could give me. Like, so you can test high blood pressure. You can do a lot of tests for, you know, diabetes. Like, there's no less, unless something's been invented. Maybe Donna can speak to this better than I can. But there was nothing that I could do medically in terms of like a lab test to say what I was suffering from. There was a lot of answering questions and saying how I felt and something that could be, which can be seen as subjective, not really, you know, objective, if that makes sense.
Right. It does. But what are some of the symptoms that you, that encouraged you to go and seek help?
Especially personally, I started not wanting to do, when I was going through it, the whole basketball, when I took the season off before for the depression in the 2000, I didn't want to work out anymore. I didn't, my eating habits changed. I was binge eating. I didn't want to get out of the bed to go to practice. Even during the season, I remember being on a bench and the coach looking at me to go in, and I would shake my head no. And I was a starter. So I wasn't, you know, I was somebody who was contributing to the team. So that's how I knew something wasn't right. And then when everything really got real serious is when in 10 years ago, when I wanted to hurt myself. That's how I knew that I needed help. The thing is, you shouldn't wait to get to that point. I had ignored a whole lot of signs. Like I had, I lost a baby 2 years before that. I just kind of buried it. I was having a lot of stress. I had a business that was struggling financially. And then I just, I guess for lack of a better term, cracked. And put myself in the hospital.
All right. That you crossed the line, even though, I mean, you drew that line and you crossed it.
Yeah.
So, okay. I'll address it to Donna. Donna, what symptoms do you have? Yes. You know, what symptoms would prompt you? I mean, you've been through it, you're there, you're moving through, and you're fighting. But, you know, try to describe some of the symptoms, though, that would prompt the person to go seek help.
One of the symptoms that I had at 16 was an ulcer. And then as I got older, it would just be, I would, like Ms. Whiting said, you don't have the desire to do anything. You don't want to do things that you don't want to participate in your hobbies anymore, things that you used to love to do. You start to seclude yourself from your friends and your family members. Leading up to my first breakdown, I stopped doing my hair. I stopped, you know, caring about how I looked, dressing. I just, I couldn't concentrate. You know, I was working at the time. I couldn't concentrate on my work. I wasn't taking care of my children properly. So, you know, it's different for different illnesses. You know, if you have bipolar disorder, it could be excessive spending, excessive sexual activity. For schizophrenia, it could just be paranoia. So for everybody, it's different. But I think the main one is when you lose your desire to do stuff and you stop caring about yourself, taking care of yourself.
Okay. Okay. All right. I know that I can recall, and I may have it occasionally, but since I've retired, not as often. You know, I used to be able to go into Penn Station. You know, when you enter Penn Station during the rush hour, you get all these people going back, coming towards you and going away from you. I would get sweaty, nauseous. I had to start looking at my phone. And I asked my mother about that. I said, "Does that ever happen to you when you get into enclosed places where there's a lot of people and you're tight, you're tightly packed?" She said, "Yeah, I used to get that on the bus when I was working." I said, "Well, what did you do about it?" She said, "That's anxiety." But I was in my 50s when she told me that. I didn't know. And then I asked one of my sisters and brothers, and they got it. They get it occasionally, depending on the circumstance or the scenario. So I believe that some of this is passed down through the DNA. You inherit certain mental deficiencies. So I think it is concrete, even though I asked a question about what these other medical, you know, people in different fields other than, you know, psychiatry may think, but it is. It has to be something. And so it is concrete. I just wanted to share with you guys.
Yeah, I'd like to add, Walter, that it's important. As a teacher, as a former teacher, I found that students needed to have a full physical exam. And I think all people need to have a full physical exam and be able to have an intimate conversation with your doctor and be able to express how you're feeling, because your doctor could also guide you into the type of care that you might need professionally concerning mental illness. You really need to develop some type of rapport with your medical professional. And I think that would help a lot as well.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I was fortunate enough to, you know, to have a personal physician, you know, for a lot of years. So I still got the same guy for 20 years, almost more than 20. All right. So when I started getting that, and I didn't get that until later in life, and I was in a battle, you know, on my job as to who's going to be the head or what, and I was passed over, and I got, you know, like ticked off because I know that the other person didn't deserve it, and I did. All right, so when they promoted that person, all of a sudden these feelings started hitting me, you know? So it could be attributed to that, like Donna said earlier, you know, PTSD. You know, you battle, and, you know, you see something that you deserve and you denied. So that may have triggered, you know, what I was predisposed to in terms of my DNA makeup. Maybe that triggered that, you know, the anxiety and things of that nature. But I did go to my doctor and I told him about it, and, you know, we addressed it. And then since I've been retired, or when I moved on to another job, you know, I don't have that issue.
Yes, sir.
I know we're getting ready to move up to close to the hour, but I did want to say that I think that what Ms. Whiting is doing by addressing mindset, because I think that winds up coming to being the common thread, and then, you know, and either second or even just as equal to mindset training is the therapy and the outlets that we all need, whether we're athletes, whether we're, you know, 15, 16, you know, being able to address traumas that we are either going through or have suffered from. And then again, that mindset training to be able to prepare what you're going to go through, you know, later on as you matriculate through life, I think is important. But one thing I think would also help in this whole entire process is that for everyone who is an advocate to get involved with your elected officials and to testify as it relates to misdiagnosis, as it relates to additional services that social services can provide, or resources that are needed within the community, to have them, you know, vote on or advocate for or get resources to your communities that help the people that need it the most, because you, having gone through it, are the best storyteller to get the message across. One legislation that I have actually advocated for that actually has already passed is that there's a three-digit designation for the suicide hotline. So instead of the 1-800 number, that is oftentimes hard to remember, the FCC, as of right now, in July of 2022, is looking to designate 988 as the three-digit suicide hotline number. So, and for those who may not be aware of that, I wanted to make sure that you are aware of that. But those are the type of things that really, obviously, definitely are going to make the difference across the world, across the nation. But please continue to doing the work that you're doing within your communities.
Yes, Val. Real quick.
All right, thank you.
Yes, Coach Val. I would like for you to talk about Coach Val and what you're doing in the communities with these women.
Well, first of all, Ernest, that's awesome.
Yes.
988. Yes. I didn't even think about that. That's that's huge.
Yes.
Especially for me, who I can't remember anybody's number.
Right.
I'll look at my phone first.
Same here.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
Yes.
But with COVID, I took a pivot with what I was doing. I lost my job. I was working for a nonprofit, and then I also had a after school program where I was teaching basketball, but also teaching life skills as well. And schools closed down. And so I lost everything. And so I decided to turn to TikTok and start talking to athletes. But then I found that female athletes were being bullied on the platform, whether it's telling them to stay in the kitchen or, you know, you suck because you're a girl. I started hyping them up in the comments and calling myself the hype woman for the female athlete. And that's what I am, Coach Val, is on TikTok, with also some comedy and some dancing and serious stuff as well. But kids want to laugh. So the stuff that does well for me is the funny stuff. But in my comments, I get a lot of interesting questions about confidence and what do I do when I make a mistake, or when I'm playing, I'm scared. And from there, I decided to become a mindset coach because I felt like this was what kids needed. And also something that I struggled with as an athlete that I didn't really have. I didn't have those tools. And so I've formed a 3-month mentoring program called the Fierce Athlete Academy, which is virtual and it's for female athletes only. And we go through different mindset hacks and just learning about little things that you can do to help you perform better on and off the court that will help you for years on. Like, it just doesn't help you for not court, but field, not just basketball. This is just not for sports. This stuff can help you in life. Like how to bounce back from a mistake. That's life. How not to be perfect. I mean, that's life. How not to have your confidence based on your last performance. Kids would perform great in a game and high confidence. And the next game, they don't perform great and their confidence is low. So how to be on a confidence train and get off the confidence roller coaster is just teaching kids that stuff. They don't get that because we're mainly focused on the physical side of the sport, physical side of training. And I think now people are just starting to get how mindset training and having your mental game sharp can give you an advantage over other athletes and also help you, like I said, down the line.
Amazing. Thank you so much for that, Walter. I know we're coming against the time. Is there anything else anyone would have final words to say right now?
No, I have nothing.
Okay. So Val, we thank you so much for coming on. All of the show notes will be in the rebroadcast on Sunday. Rebroadcast on all streaming platforms, wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to this Sunday after 3 p.m. Thank you to our guest, Val Whiting, our special panel guest member, Diva with Depression, for joining us. Thank you to our weekly panel member Greg, Ernest, Christopher, Judy, and Jean. You can follow us at thewaltweekly.com. We are on IG and Facebook, The Walt Weekly, Twitter, Walt Weekly, and anywhere you can get your podcast. We appreciate everyone for joining us. This was a true blessing to have you, Ms. Val, on here, and hopefully we saved a life today.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, thank you, Val. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Don't forget to follow, folks. Don't forget to follow.
Follow, like, and share. Follow the world.
There you go. Sweet. Thank you all. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye. Have a great weekend, everyone.